the broadcaster at 40. This week, WTIC celebrates 40 years of broadcasting. And throughout the week, we'll be presenting our story, the story of the broadcaster at 40. WTIC was operating 17 hours a day on weekdays and 14 and a half hours on Sundays when the year 1935 was ushered in. Regular reports on the activities of the Connecticut legislature appeared in 1935. Also arriving on the TIC scene was a new commentator who attracted wide attention by his sound analysis of events occurring in foreign lands and his accurate predictions of the ends to which these events would lead. His name was Andre Schenker, Associate Professor of History at the University of Connecticut. Professor Schenker eventually became WTIC's foreign affairs analyst for a long period. His far-sighted commentaries were entitled History in the Headlines.
Dating, a week or so ago, we had begun a discussion of the text of the first five treaties which have been completed. I told you at the time that, as events permitted, we would continue the discussion of these treaties. I also
local music programs presented performers like Joseph Bloom, Sid Pearl, Salvatore Di Stefano, John Gowan, and a new name was added to the announcing staff, Bernard Mullins. September of 1936 marked another milestone in WTIC history. In that month, the station joined the Yankee Network, an affiliation that was to last about 6 years. One of 36's most popular programs was Hull's Hour of Cheer, produced by Leonard Patricelli.
Presenting Hull's Hour of Cheer and offering for your entertainment, the Four Royal Waiters.
With a sign on the table and a good song drinking beer.
Your favorite voice in your favorite song, Fred Wade.
Romance, romance may come with a spring or a fall.
And the dancing rhythms of Rudy Martin and his orchestra.
The Hour of Cheer brought the big band sound into southern New England homes with all the newest hits.
Cheer continues with the latest song hit from the pen of Carmen Lombardo, Dreamy Eyes.
As the big band sound flooded the airwaves in 1936, the Connecticut River was also demonstrating its prowess by spilling rampaging floodwaters over thousands of acres of the Connecticut Valley. Mr. Morency, do you recall what the station's major problem was during that period?
Well, our first problem was to stay on the air. The 36 flood wasn't as bad as far as staying on the air was concerned.
WTIC stayed on the air with battery-operated equipment downtown here in the downtown area.
Supervisor of Engineers Al Jackson was on duty throughout the flood emergency.
We used our battery-operated remote amplifier because all our AC-operated equipment was dead because the Dutch Point power station had gone out. It was completely surrounded by water, as a matter of fact. And the only communication that we had between, or the city had, I should say, between this power station and the headquarters here in the city was by ham radio. And there was a very good friend of ours that worked for the light company at that time, had some ham radio gear in his car, and he was down there, and the car was there at the time, and as the water came up, they kept raising the car up, and they finally got it up onto the next floor. And he was the only means of communication between this isolated power station and the city. And the only way that we could communicate with him was from the top of the Traveler's Tower, where we had what was known in those days as 5-meter equipment. And WTIC had this equipment, but in order to operate it without power up there, it was necessary to use storage batteries, of course. And Fred Edwards and I carried many a storage battery from the street level to the top of the Traveler's Observation Tower just to operate this equipment. If you can imagine all those flights of stairs with storage batteries, it wasn't an easy job.
Well, the floodwaters went their ways, and in 1937, so did the staff musicians. Recordings and transcriptions had taken over the role of providing music, and Larry Kenfield, the man who had been music librarian since 1929, took charge of a fast-growing library of recordings and transcriptions. The library, which Larry Kenfield now directs, contains over 90,000 selections. Staff musicians were to reappear in 1938 when musical director Moshe Perinoff was authorized to engage 14 staff musicians for a new string ensemble.
The makers of the famous Branford oil burner present Stories in Song.
Say it with me.
Stories in Song, a quarter hour of drama, music, and romance brought to you by that colorful character and genial teller of tales, the old Colonel. This evening's Story in Song, the final one in the current fall series, dramatizes for you the old Colonel's own version of the most famous of all poems by Robert Service, The Shooting of Dan McGrew. But first, a brief message from our sponsor.
Stories in Song, written and produced by Leonard Patricelli, took to the air with songs chosen to complement stories told by the old Colonel, played by Bernard Mullins.
And now for the old Colonel and his own Story in Song version of the famous poem, The Shooting of Dan McGrew. A bunch of the boys were hooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. A famous first line to a famous poem. And you'll excuse us, folks, if prior to presenting the poem, we bring you a little prologue setting forth some of the unknown facts which had so much to do with the ultimate story that you all know as The Shooting of Dan McGrew. Let us go back to the year 1891. The town...
New England was to feel the wrath of nature again when in 1938, one of the hemisphere's most destructive hurricanes roared through a dark September day, dropping trees and power lines, washing shoreline buildings to sea, and taking an expensive toll in human life. Mr. Morency, how do you recall this emergency?
The 38 hurricane blew down some of our wire to the mountain. But we got back on, I think, in about 22 or 28 minutes. And then we stayed on for about 5 days, day and night. But I remember over in the sixth floor of Grove Street there, some of our boys had to carry batteries up six flights in order to get enough power to drive our studio equipment. And all power was out, of course. And since then, we have in this building, of course, as you know, we have a fine diesel. And out on the mountain, we have a magnificent power supply, which we flip over to with a loss of about a quarter second if we lose power. So what we tried to do and did do, we did a great many network feeds during the 38 hurricane particularly.
Yet another storm was brewing in 1938, this one far across the Atlantic. Not a force of the elements. This was a human tempest.
I now lead my people as their first soldier. And behind me, let the world know there now marches a nation, and a different nation from that in 1918.
At home, Franklin Roosevelt was listening as Hitler ranted on. The American leader replied in these words, read by an NBC correspondent.
The government of the United States has no political involvement in Europe and will assume no obligations in the conduct of the present negotiations. Yet, in our own right, we recognize our responsibilities as a part of a world of neighbors. The conscience and the impelling desire of the people of my country demand that the voice of their government be raised again and yet again to avert and to avoid war. Signed, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
And in England, a new giant was emerging for the free world. Winston Churchill had some thoughts about the fanatic German.
Stripped of its verbiage and its trimmings, Herr Hitler's speech reveals a wish to isolate Poland and to present an issue to Poland in the most plausible form, but backed by a somber gesture. The denunciation of the non-aggression pact with Poland, which was not to end until 1944, must be regarded as the most serious feature of the speech and as a new cause for anxiety. The Hitler method has always been, I must remind you, to take one step at a time, and while reassuring others, to get one country shut up with him alone. For all these reasons, it is of the highest consequence that there should be no slackening of the vigilance and preparation of the peace-seeking power of Europe, and no diminution of the influence which the United States is exercising for the common good. It is upon the continuance of these vast processes that any real escape from our dangers must depend. There are many passages in Herr Hitler's speech which would seem designed to induce Great Britain to abandon her precautions and to withdraw from the part she has pledged herself to play in Eastern Europe. Such blandishments have on several occasions been the prelude to acts of Nazi violence. They will not have any effect, I can assure you, upon the now thoroughly awakened British public opinion.
In Hartford in 1939, the Travelers Broadcasting Service Corporation was again looking ahead, this time to a new medium of communication. Long before most people had ever heard of it, let alone seen it, WTIC applied in June for a license to operate a television station. On radio, a young harp soloist by the name of Bobby Maxwell was giving weekly harp recitals. And a new noon-hour music and comedy feature debuted.
Present New England's own singing star, Fred Wade, and Batiste himself from Canada. Listen here, Batiste. You can't ask questions on a radio question hour. You don't even know the answers.
I know plenty of answers. Go ahead.
All right. Who was the first man?
George Washington.
You see, you're wrong. The first man was Adam.
Oh, well, that don't affairs. How I know you was talking about foreigners.
Noontime Varieties featured Fred Wade and Batiste himself and was introduced by Bruce Kern with Hal Kolb at the organ.
And now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to that romantic Romeo, that beloved personality of the airways, that one
Thank
and only...
Thank you very much, my friend. I didn't expect to introduce like that.
Quiet, Batiste. As I was saying, ladies and gentlemen, I give you now your singing host, Fred Wade.
Oh, Fred Wade. That's a nice thank for gave anybody there.
Out of my way, Shorty, before I step on you. All right, Al.
Out of the darkness you suddenly appeared. You smiled and I was taken by surprise. I guess I should have seen right through you. But the moon got in my eyes.
A part of the noontime period on Saturday was occupied in 39 by a farm and home series. It was called the Connecticut Farm Forum and was conducted by Frank Atwood. Of course, Frank later joined our regular staff as farm director, the position he holds today. And in 1939, sports fans first heard...
Howdy, sports fans and everybody. How are you tonight? This is Bob Steele with Strictly Sports.
Yet another day in 1939 heralded WTIC's entry into the field of FM broadcasting. Still in the experimental stage, the station received permission to build equipment necessary to broadcast by frequency modulation. And on February 5th, 1940, the new station went on the air with the call letters W1XSO.
I'd like to learn that dance where I troll in all over the place, you know, and throw it around my head and whirl it around my neck and all that stuff.
Well, you're not getting into any dancing like that. You want to whirl someone around your neck, get Louie or a dummy or somebody.
Remember Jake and Lena? Well, if Jake and Lena were friends of yours, Gene and Glenn were acquaintances, too. On August 3rd, 1940, this twosome, or could it be a foursome, began a happy relationship with Southern New England residents.
With a howdy we greet you, oh, the morning is grand. We'd love to meet you and shake your hand. Oh, there's nothing like music when the morning is gray. It brings us sunshine all through the day. If trouble's troubling you, kind friend, we'll do our best and try to send a smile or two just to end your worries for a while. So do you say howdy, oh, the morning is grand, the best old morning in the best old land.
Well, Jake and Lena are comparatively peaceful today. No lions are on the loose to worry about. The pet shop is functioning once more. There seems to be just one thing on Lena's mind today. And she's asking Glenn what he thinks about it right now, so let's drop in on them and hear what's being said.
I found this here animal list, and Jake has checked off a lot of wild animals, but you can see for yourself here. Here it is right here.
Oh, I see. Oh, he isn't planning on ordering these, I'm sure.
Well, you never know what Jake is going to do. I wish you'd ask him about
it. I will. She has a python marked here and also a black leopard.
And an elephant over here he's got checked off. Now, what could I do with an elephant in a pet shop?
Oh, that's out of the question.
Well, certainly.
20-foot python.
Yes, imagine. What is a python?
A snake.
A snake?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness me. In my pet shop, a snake.
How's business at the pet shop?
I sold my first canary yesterday since the trouble started. I sold a chopper.
Chopper? What's that, sort of a woodpecker?
It's pretty good, Glenn. It's a canary.
Oh, is it a canary?
American chopper, they call it, and they sing their heads off.
They do, huh?
Yeah, you see, they ain't importing them Harts Mountain Rollers now on account of the war. You know, I can't get them.
I understand, like a lot of items.
Mm-hmm. So, I tell how Mr. Weber come up after Ginger, did I tell you?
What was that?
Did I tell you how Mr. Weber come after Ginger?
Oh, is Mr. Weber back in town?
Oh, yes. He had a fit laughing when he heard how Ginger got loose and scared everybody to death nearly.
Personally, I don't think it was any laughing matter.
I know it. And anyway, he come over to see the lion, and the poor thing was so happy to see him.
What do you mean, happy?
Well, he rubbed his head against the bar so Mr. Weber could scratch his head.
The lion did?
Mm-hmm. So finally, Mr. Weber went right into the cage, and Ginger just laid down and rolled over like a great big cat.
He did.
And Mr. Weber just patted him and rubbed him.
Can you beat that? Yeah. He wasn't a bit savage, huh?
No, not a bit. Mr. Weber says if you have the confidence of a wild animal and they like you, you can do anything with them.
New programs came in strength in 1940, and another show that was to enjoy a long run and delight listeners started with Bruce Kern calling...
Is Springfield ready?
Yeah!
Is Hartford ready?
Yeah!
And make way for the Quiz of Two Cities, presented by Listerine Toothpaste. You're in for another fast and furious quiz session between Springfield and Hartford. The last week, Springfield added another solid win to their season's total, and right now our big scoreboard reads 56 wins for Springfield, 51 wins for Hartford, with 7 ties. And ready to introduce his Springfield team is that never-lost-for-words fella, Turner Cook.
And thanks, folks, and greetings from the broadcast lounge of the Hotel Sheraton, Springfield. And Bruce Kern, I've got a never-lost-the-right-answer team tonight, representing the Boy Scouts organization here in Springfield. Wait till you hear them.
Okay, Cookie. Now, George, Bo, and Hartford, what have you got to say?
Hiya, Quiz fans!
Woo!
Wow. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was a Class A applause from the Boy Scouts in our audience here tonight. And they give that only for Class A things. They didn't mean that for me. That was for our team tonight, I know. And greetings to you, Bruce, too. Might just as well say hello to Cookie now, because after my team from the Charter Oak Council Boy Scouts of America gets finished, oh, I'm sure he won't even talk to me. He'll be so mad.
That's the round one bell, and here again is Turner Cook and his number one contestant.
And here she is, Mrs. John Dolan, all set to deliver. Good evening, Mrs. Dolan.
Good evening, Mr. Cook.
They tell me that you are a den mother down there in Long Meadow and have one of the largest scout packs in this part of the country.
That's right.
Is that right, the largest in this part of the country?
It's the largest in the country.
All right, we go into your next three questions worth 40 team points and 10 silver dollars. Now, the first one, Mrs. Dolan, is worth 10 whole points. Answer yes or no to this one. The word September contains more letters than any other month in the year. Now, answer yes or no, and I'll give you 10 seconds.
Yes.
Oh, sure it does. Yes, ma'am, in 3 seconds she did it. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Here we go. Number two. The first state to be admitted to the Union after the original 13 was Maine, Vermont, or Ohio?
Maine.
Oh, I'm awful sorry on that one. I'm awful sorry. Third question, worth 20 points and $5. You know that a bride is a newly married woman and a well is a source of water. But what's a bride well? What's the Bridewell?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm awful sorry. And I will tell you a little bit later, but here's your 5 silver dollars.
Yet another new program entry in 1940 was the Sabbath Message, which has every Sunday, since that date, presented representatives of the three major faiths in Greater Hartford with inspirational messages. In Washington, President Roosevelt spoke before a troubled Congress.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives. These are ominous days, days whose swift and shocking developments force every neutral nation to look to its defenses in the light of new factors. The brutal force of modern offensive war has been loosed in all its horror. New powers of destruction, incredibly swift and deadly, have been developed, and those who wield them are ruthless and daring. No old defense is so strong that it requires no further strengthening, and no attack is so unlikely or impossible that it may be ignored. Let us examine without self-deception the dangers which confront us. Let us measure our strength and our defense without self-delusion. The clear fact is that the American people must recast their thinking.
From England came the voice of Winston Churchill reporting the disastrous Dunkirk.
The disastrous military events which have happened in France during the last fortnight have not come to me with any sense of surprise. Indeed, I told the House of Commons, as you may remember, almost exactly a fortnight ago, that the worst possibilities were open. And I made it perfectly clear that whatever happened in France would make no difference to the resolve of Britain and the British Empire to fight on. As I then said, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. During the last few days, we have successfully brought off the great majority of the troops we had on the lines of communication in France. And 7/8 of all the troops we have sent to France since the beginning of the war, that is to say about 350,000 out of 400,000 men, are safely back in this country. Others are still fighting with the French. We have also brought back a great mass of stores, rifles and munitions of all kinds, which had been accumulated in France during the last 9 months. We have therefore in this island today a very large and powerful military force.
In January 1941, WTIC put a mighty shoulder behind yet another community effort. General Manager Paul W. Morency approached officials of the Hartford Courant with the idea of jointly sponsoring an annual Mile of Dimes campaign for the aid of polio victims. On January 15, 1940, the first red, white, and blue booth was opened on Main Street across from the old State House. From the booth, Gene and Glenn exhorted listeners and passers-by to drop 89,872 dimes on the line, exactly the number of dimes in 1 mile. But the proceeds of that spectacular first Mile of Dimes drive amounted to $18,192.20, or more than 2 miles of dimes. Twice the goal. Here's how it was done.
Lena.
What?
Can I have it just a moment?
Yes.
There's a box with $21.79 in it, but that was handed by one of the officers. Not a name on it. It says your contribution.
Oh,
but it doesn't say who.
Well, isn't that funny? And it's got a pink card here, but anyway, we want to thank them, and it's a lovely thought anyway, even if we don't know who it's from. What's your name?
Mrs. Victor Sperry from the Nile Street Hospital. Mrs. Marion LeClaire is the supervisor.
She is? Oh.
I have 51 dimes. 51 dimes, and one is for,
one is for me, is it?
No.
One is for Jake.
Five. $5 for Lena, yeah. And one dime for Jake.
Well, thank you very
and then
much.
There's one of the nurses, Miss McNevins, felt very badly to think we were giving all the money to Lena.
Wow.
She's got 2 dimes here for Jake.
Well, you
and I can give you our telephone number.
Well, thanks, and tell the girls if I ever get a headache, I'll be over to see them.
Up to this time, the station had occupied a number of dial positions, most recently the 1040 spot. In May 1941, WTIC assumed its now well-known 1080 position on the dial. Yes, it was the end of the line for the old 1040 frequency, and it was also the end of the line for Hartford's familiar yellow trolley cars.
There go the doors. They've closed, and we'll get down here close to the wheels, and there's the bell. Hear the air release, and now here we go. And as I say, on Sunday, July the 27th. In just a few hours, motorized service will take over in Hartford and the trolley will disappear from the scene. This has been a special events broadcast of WTIC, brought to you through the shortwave transmitter WEKW. Your announcer has been Ed Anderson. We return you now to our studio.
Listeners, on December 4th, 1941, were paying special attention to news of worsening conditions in Europe when a local bulletin stunned the community. A portion of the new Charter Oak Bridge had suddenly collapsed as workmen attempted to complete the span.
The Hartford Police Department has requested WTIC to urge all persons to remain away from the scene of the Connecticut River Bridge disaster to permit police and other officials to carry out rescue work. And we take you now to the site of the new Connecticut River Bridge.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Steele speaking to you from the Connecticut River Bridge, the new one that's under construction now, right near Dutch Point, just about 200 yards, I'd say, north of the Hartford Electric Light Company plant here at Dutch Point. And we're speaking to you from the west bank of the river. The bridge, as you have heard by now, no doubt, collapsed. That is one span between two of the piers, the last pier on the bank and the first pier out in the water. The span going across those two piers has collapsed just as they were putting it in place. Some 30-odd men were said to be...
The community was still speculating as to the cause of the bridge collapse when on Sunday, December 7th, 1941...
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
Americans prepared for a sober Christmas celebration. On Christmas Eve, the ears of the free world bent toward radio sets to absorb the words of President Roosevelt and England's Churchill.
The year 1941 has brought upon our nation a war of aggression by powers dominated by arrogant rulers whose selfish purpose is to destroy free institutions. They would thereby take from the freedom-loving peoples of the earth the hard-won liberties gained over many centuries. The new year of 1942 calls for the courage and the resolution of old and young to help to win a world struggle in order that we may preserve all that we hold dear. We are confident in our devotion to country, in our love of freedom, in our inheritance of courage. But our strength, as the strength of all men everywhere, is of greater avail as God upholds us. Therefore, I do hereby appoint the first day of the year 1942 as a day of prayer, of asking forgiveness for our shortcomings of the past, of consecration to the tasks of the present, of asking God's help in days to come. We need his guidance that this people may be a humble people, that it may be humble in spirit, but strong in the conviction of the right, steadfast to endure sacrifice, and brave to achieve a victory of liberty and peace. And so I am asking my associate, my old and good friend, to say a word to the people of America, old and young, tonight. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Fellow workers, fellow soldiers in the cause, this is a strange Christmas Eve. Almost the whole world is locked in deadly struggle. Armed with the most terrible weapons which science can devise, the nations advance upon each other. ill would it be for us this Christmas tide if we were not sure that no greed for the lands or wealth of any other people, no vulgar ambition, no morbid lust for material gain at the expense of others had led us to the field. Ill would it be for us if that were so. Here in the midst of war, raging and roaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearths and homes, here amid all these tumults, we have tonight the peace of the spirit in each cottage home and in every generous heart.
Hello, everyone. This is Bernard Mullen speaking to you from New Haven and introducing the 325th broadcast of Yale Interprets the News.
Yale Interprets the News, a new series of prepared interviews with Yale faculty members, began in January of 1942 with Bernard Mullins as interrogator. Under the modified title of Yale Reports, this program is still heard every Sunday evening on WTIC. The war effort was well underway in early 42. WTIC was operating in accordance with the U.S. Office of Censorship's Code of Wartime Practices as of June 18, 1942. And shortly thereafter, WTIC was authorized to sell war bonds. It was in these early days of the war that one of the nation's most stirring wartime programs was regularly originated from the United States Coast Guard Academy in New London by WTIC. Heard throughout the country on NBC and throughout the world on shortwave, it was the United States Coast Guard on parade.
Big things were happening musically in the early 40s. WTIC was broadcasting the Daily Tune Test, Victor Arden's orchestra, Rally Round the Bandstand, Harry Horlick's orchestra, and on May 8, 1942, from the stage of the State Theater, George Beau gave the cue and a TIC cast swung into action.
Jack, turn on the radio, will you? It's time for that program.
What program?
Well, the one I mentioned at dinner. The sign-up for victory show.
Oh, that's just another of those pep talks about buying war bonds.
It is not. It's about some new plan of the Treasury Department.
What kind of a plan? The company's taking money for bonds out of my paycheck now.
Well, I don't know if this has anything to do with that or not. I did hear, though, that if all the people all over the country pledged enough, our taxes might not go so high.
Aye, that is news. Let's find out about this.
I thought that'd get you. And besides, your favorite band is on the same show.
Tommy Dorsey?
Right. And not only Tommy Dorsey, but the Orpheus and Bacchus Club of Yale and Gene and Glenn.
Say, that is something. Turn up the radio, will you?
Okay.
For victory. From the stage of the State Theater in Hartford, the radio stations of Connecticut present the program in behalf of the pledge campaign of the United States Treasury. Victory means freedom.
Freedom to enjoy those privileges which we have made our own since 1776. Privileges so taken for granted, we seldom give them pause. The right to play the music we love, no matter the race, creed, or color of its composer.
Germany, Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra would find this selection forbidden, since its composer does not belong to what Mr. Goebbels terms the super race.
Yes, it was the music of Tommy Dorsey and the singing of the skinny kid from Hoboken, Frank Sinatra.
Blue skies smiling at me. Nothing but blue skies. Do I see?
Blue skies,
blue birds singing a song. Nothing but bluebirds all day long.
Slap, slap, happy. Sunshine everywhere. And everybody's happy as the square of the fair.
Hi, hi.
All the days are hurrying by when you're in love. How they fly, blue days. All of them gone. Nothing but blue skies
overhead
from now on.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Oh, yes, there was good music. And there was also good humor, courtesy of Gene and Glenn with Jake and Lena.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you, thank you. Lena!
What do you want, Glenn?
Oh, my. What a lovely new hat.
Yes,
huh?
Isn't it pretty?
It looks like a victory hat.
It is.
It is, huh?
I got it specially because we were here with Tommy Dorsey tonight.
Oh,
you
is
know?
That so?
I
huh?
wanted to be all dressed up.
Is that so? Well, you really are a dream. It's a lovely thing.
I look awful pretty tonight, don't
yes,
I?
Yes, you do. It's a wonderful audience.
Isn't it a lovely audience?
Yeah,
well, Tommy Dorsey always has a big crowd.
Yes,
you know,
he does, always. And why all this talk about Tommy Dorsey?
Well, you know, I've been singing a lot of opera stuff and everything for years, and I
yes.
thought this is a wonderful chance for me to kind of swing out on something.
Oh, you do? Well, Lena, you're not exactly the type to swing out on something.
I know it, but I look nice, don't I?
Yes, you do look nice. That's
and
granted.
Besides, Tommy Dorsey might need a singer for the orchestra, you can't tell.
Oh, that's right. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that sound lovely, Tommy and Lena Dorsey?
As the Dorsey Band hit the downbeat for Song of India, the audience reached down deep into their pockets and came up with dollars for victory bonds.
In the TIC studios, everyone pressed on even harder to keep a steady flow of morale-boosting programming coming. Everything was pushed into the fight for victory. Yes, it was V for Victory, dot, 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 dash, first introduced to TIC listeners on July 4th, 1943. And heard every hour, on the hour, since then. New programs in the regular schedule spurred listeners on to support the war effort even more. Southern New England listeners listened to programs like
Connecticut Yankees at Camp Wheeler,
the Armed Forces Club Sing,
Uncle Jim's Victory Garden, and Here Comes the Band.
Rationing.
You're in the Army now.
Submarine Patrol and Connecticut on the Alert.
Wings for Tomorrow, plus Connecticut Men and Women in the War.
Quartermaster Quarter Hour and the Victory Hour, broadcast every Saturday night, featured name bands. The Dorseys, Hal McIntyre, Sammy Kay, Horace Height, Charlie Spivak, and Louis Armstrong, with autographed albums of records going to those in the audience who purchased $500 war bonds.
And there were special remote programs too numerous to mention. In January of 1944, two wars were being fought. Around the world, American GIs pushed the fighting war into the laps of the Germans and Japanese. At home, WTIC was pushing the war against polio with a goal of 5 miles of dimes. A generous community responded with $51,358.35, roughly 5 7/10 miles, well over the anticipated goal.
This is Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour. All night long, bulletins have been pouring in from Berlin claiming that D-Day is here, claiming that the invasion of Western Europe has begun. Let me read you several of the latest bulletins. One says that a report, unconfirmed by Allied sources, of course, says that heavy fighting is taking place between the Germans and invasion forces on the Normandy Peninsula, about 31 miles southwest of Le Havre. Another bulletin, also from Berlin Radio and unconfirmed, says the British-American landing operations against the western coast of Europe from the sea and from the air are stretching over the entire area between Cherbourg and Le Havre, a distance of about 60 miles. I repeat, there is no confirmation. And here's another bulletin just in. DNB, the German agency, says, this is unconfirmed, that the most important airdromes in the area of the Normandy Peninsula of France have been wiped out. Now, I presume that means wiped out by the Allies. As you may have heard on earlier broadcasts, all three German news agencies have begun broadcasting these stories that the invasion is here. But there is no Allied confirmation as yet. The first report came out shortly after midnight, and since then we've been flooded with reports from Berlin. Paris radio, strangely enough, has not confirmed any of these reports. And now we have just been informed that we can expect, in a very few seconds, a very important broadcast from the British capital.
June 6, 1944. WTIC was prepared for the assault on France by the Allied forces.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is New York, NBC Newsroom again. Men and women of the United States, this is a momentous hour in world history. This is the invasion of Hitler's Europe, the zero hour of the Second Front. The men of General Dwight Eisenhower are leaving their landing barges, fighting their way up the beaches into the fortress of Nazi Europe. They are moving in from the sea to attack the enemy under a mammoth cloud of fighter planes, under a ceiling of screaming shells from Allied warships. The first news flashes do not say, but a large proportion of this assault is believed to be in the hands of American men. They are making the attack side by side with the British Tommies who were bombed and blasted out of Europe at Dunkirk. Now, at this hour, they are bombing and blasting their way back again.
In July 1944, the Allied forces were pushing across Europe, and the home folks were in a mood to relax a bit. Hundreds of Central Connecticut men, women, and children were breathlessly enjoying the excitement of Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus under the big tent in Hartford on July 6th, when suddenly the faces of smiling, excited circus fans turned to masks of panic. Bernard Mullins and George Bowe were at the scene of the Holocaust.
Hello, everyone. Well, Hartford this afternoon suffered one of the greatest catastrophes in its history, when during a matinee performance of Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, the big tent suddenly burst into flame and burned to the ground, causing more than 100 deaths and unestimated casualties. WTIC's George Bowe and myself were on the grounds within a few minutes after the conflagration had leveled the big show, and while smoke was still rising from the horrible mass of canvas and poles and bleachers.
That's right, Bernard. According to eyewitnesses at the scene, the fire started at about 2:33 after the show had been underway a quarter of an hour, and we were on the grounds about 3 o'clock. Bernard, what was that story that the woman survivor told you there?
Well, she was a lady from Meriden, George, attending the show with her 6-year-old son. Fortunately, they were seated near an exit at the far end of the tent and managed to escape. Her little boy was seated directly in front of her in the 6th row. The first indication of anything wrong came when the cry of fire was heard, and immediately a wisp of smoke came from the side wall near the front entrance. This lady pushed her youngster off the seat, and as he landed on the ground, she told him not to rush, but to keep going toward that exit. They were among the first dozen or so out.
Yes, and that wisp of smoke developed in a matter of seconds into a blazing inferno. In fact, in 2.5 minutes, the entire tent was enveloped in flames and had collapsed. An eyewitness in an office across the street told us that it appeared almost like spontaneous combustion, so quickly was the big tent a mass of flames.
Quoting from Francis Chase's book, Sound and Fury.
Needless to say, regular programs were canceled as the entire staff devoted itself to the task of spiking wild rumors, passing on accurate information, and reassuring families throughout the community. Service in the public interest was the uppermost thought in WTIC's swiftly planned coverage of the disaster. The incident proved that radio has humane objectives that can be achieved in times of great trial, largely because of the huge listener confidence placed in the medium by an audience that has learned to accept the honesty and reliability of broadcasting's public service role.
The weatherman forewarned Connecticut of another disaster which visited the state in September, the worst Atlantic hurricane since 1938. Again, WTIC was ready.
Hello, everyone. This is Bernard Mullins of the WTIC staff, speaking to you from an open balcony in the Travelers Tower, 500 feet above the streets in downtown Hartford. And this is it, folks. The Atlantic hurricane of 1944 finds Hartford in its path, as did its predecessor of 1938. 6 years ago, almost to the week. To say that the wind is blowing a gale up here is putting it mildly. We can hardly hold our feet up here against the gusts of wind and rain that swing around this open balcony, a windy spot and a fair day. Although the wind velocity is said to be but 35 miles an hour 15 minutes ago, with gusts ranging from 40 to 70 miles an hour, it surely must have increased or else we're in an area of gust only. We can look down on the city of Hartford from this vantage point. The lights are still burning. There has been no serious power shortage in Hartford. I understand that some of the outlying towns are without power. As a matter of fact, our own station is operating on reduced power because of the fact that the line is down between Unionville, the powerhouse, and Avon, our transmitter.
As the 10-year period, 1935 to 1944, came to an end, WTIC looked not back at a decade of major accomplishments, but ahead. Ahead to increasing its every effort. The effort to keep Connecticut men and women at home and overseas informed and active. Efforts to raise more money for defense. Efforts to raise more money to fight polio. And the ever-constant effort to provide a service for the benefit of the area. Thursday, during this same time period, we'll be taking an audio visit to the decade 1945-1955. Reminiscences and comments by some of the TIC folks who played major roles in the period, plus some of the most exciting music ever recorded. The third decade of The Broadcaster at 40.